A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And it's one of those questions where the moment you hear it, you realize you've been living inside the tension without ever naming it. He's got ADHD and depression, both diagnosed, both managed. But here's the thing. The ADHD feels intrinsic, like it's just how his brain is wired. The depression, by contrast, feels secondary. Something that showed up because of what the ADHD made difficult, not something that was there from the start. And he noticed something strange in how these two conditions are treated. Neurologists diagnose and manage ADHD all the time. They almost never touch ordinary depression. That stays with psychiatry. So, his question is, where does that distinction actually rest? Does depression have the same kind of neurological roots ADHD does? And if so, why the professional firewall?
This is one of those questions that seems simple until you start pulling on it, and then the whole diagnostic architecture starts to wobble.
Which is, I suspect, exactly why he asked it.
Because Daniel's living with both, and he can feel that the labels don't quite map onto the experience. The ADHD is treated like a brain condition. Stimulants, neurologists, brain scans in some cases. The depression is treated like. And his intuition that the ADHD is more neurological isn't just a feeling. There's actually a fascinating empirical basis for it, but it's not as clean as the professional boundaries would suggest.
Let's step back and ask the obvious question. What actually makes something a neurological disorder versus a psychiatric one? Because I think most people assume it's about whether there's something physically wrong with the brain. Neurological means brain damage, lesions, seizures, something you can point at on a scan. Well, the mind, something less tangible.
That assumption is exactly what makes this so interesting, because it's wrong in both directions. The formal boundary is partly historical accident, partly professional turf, and only partly biology. Neurology as a specialty emerged from 19th century neuropathology, physicians mapping brain lesions to specific deficits. Broca's area, Wernicke's area, the motor strip. You could see the damage, correlate it with the symptom, and build a map. Psychiatry emerged from a completely different tradition, asylum medicine, and then psychoanalysis. The focus was on symptoms and narratives, not lesions. These two traditions developed entirely separate institutions, separate journals, separate residency programs, separate billing codes, and they've persisted even as the underlying science has converged.
The distinction is basically a fossil.
A well-funded, legally entrenched fossil. And here's where it gets personal for Daniel's question. If you look at the actual brain science, depression shows measurable, replicable changes. Reduced hippocampal volume, meta-analyses consistently show an 8-10% reduction in people with recurrent major depressive disorder. Altered default mode network connectivity. Dysregulation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis with elevated cortisol. These are not subtle findings. If you showed those numbers to a neurologist without telling them the diagnosis, they'd say something is clearly wrong with this brain.
They don't say that. They don't treat it.
They don't. And the reason gets at the core tension. Those depression biomarkers, as real as they are not specific. Reduced hippocampal volume also shows up in anxiety disorders, in PTSD, and even in people with chronic stress who don't meet criteria for any diagnosis. The default mode network hyperconnectivity overlaps with rumination in general, not just depressive rumination. The HPA axis findings correlate with early life adversity more than they correlate with any particular diagnosis. So a neurologist looking at a single patient's brain scan cannot say, "Ah yes, this is depression." They can say, "This brain shows signs of chronic stress or affective dysregulation." That's not enough to anchor a neurological diagnosis in the classical sense.
Whereas with ADHD, it's more specific.
Significantly more specific. And this is where Daniel's intuition about ADHD feeling more neurological has real scientific backing. The dopamine and norepinephrine transporter gene variants, DAT1, DRD4, are consistently implicated. Structural differences in the prefrontal cortex and basal ganglia show up across studies with remarkable consistency. Functional MRI findings of reduced activation in frontal striatal circuits during executive function tasks are so replicable that some researchers have argued they should be used diagnostically. The heritability estimates are among the highest in psychiatry, 70 to 80%, comparable to autism and bipolar disorder. Depression's heritability sits around 40%, with environmental factors playing a much larger role.
ADHD looks more like a classical brain disease because the signal is cleaner.
The neuroanatomical signatures are relatively distinct. The genetic architecture is more straightforward, and the treatment response tells the same story. Stimulants target the identified neurotransmitter deficits directly, and they work rapidly and predictably. That's not how antidepressants work at all. SSRIs modulate broader systems, serotonin, norepinephrine, with delayed, variable responses. The effect is more consistent with a systems-level dysregulation than a focal deficit. It's the difference between a broken switch and a room where the thermostat is badly calibrated and also the windows are open and also someone keeps adjusting it.
That's a useful image. The ADHD brain has a specific circuit that's underactive. The depressed brain has a whole climate system that's gone wrong, and it's hard to say which part is the cause and which parts are downstream effects.
That's exactly why the clinical specialties have divided the way they have. A neurologist can look at ADHD and say, I recognize this pattern. It maps onto specific circuits. I have tools that target those circuits. With depression, the pattern is diffuse. It involves circuits that overlap with anxiety, with trauma responses, with personality. The neurologist's toolkit, focal interventions, precise localization, doesn't match the problem.
Here's what I think Daniel is really getting at. Even if the science supports a distinction in specificity, the practical consequences of labeling one condition, neurological, and the other, psychiatric, are enormous. And they don't always track the science.
They absolutely don't. And I think that's where we need to go next. Because the biology gives us a partial answer, but the real-world implications of this divide are where it gets personal. Insurance coverage, disability accommodations, how patients think about themselves, which specialists they get referred to. All of that flows from a distinction that, scientifically, is more gradient than binary.
For someone like Daniel, who's got both conditions, that gradient isn't academic. It determines whether he's seeing one specialist or two, whether his ADHD medication and his antidepressant are being managed by people who talk to each other, whether his depression is treated as a separate condition or as something that might partly resolve if the ADHD is better managed.
And there's a deeper identity question here too, which Daniel touched on directly. The ADHD feels like him. The depression feels like something that happened to him. That distinction, intrinsic versus reactive, shapes how people relate to their diagnoses, how much self-blame they carry, and even how they respond to treatment. Research on illness narratives shows that patients with neurological labels consistently report less self-blame than those with psychiatric labels, even when their symptoms are comparably severe. The label itself changes the experience.
The question isn't just, where does the biology draw the line? It's, what does the line do to people?
And that's what we should dig into. To answer Daniel's question directly, what is the actual distinction? We have to look at how the diagnostic manuals draw the line and then immediately admit that the line doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Which sounds about right for anything involving both the brain and a bureaucracy.
The formal definition is deceptively straightforward. A neurological disorder involves identifiable structural or functional pathology in the brain, a lesion, a circuit-level abnormality, a neurotransmitter system disruption you can point to and say, there, that's the problem. A psychiatric disorder, by contrast, is defined by symptom clusters. The DSM gives you a checklist. If you have 5 of these 9 symptoms for 2 weeks, it's major depressive disorder, no biomarker required.
The distinction is basically, can you point at it, or are you just describing it?
That's the textbook answer. And for a long time, that mapped onto a real practical difference. Strokes, tumors, epilepsy, you could see those. Depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, you couldn't. But that clean division started crumbling decades ago, and we're now at a point where it's actively misleading.
Because we can see depression now. Not as clearly as a tumor, but it's there.
It's absolutely there. And this is the puzzle Daniel's question exposes. We've got hippocampal volume reductions, default mode network, hyperconnectivity, HPA axis dysregulation. These are physical, measurable phenomena. If the definition of neurological is there's something structurally or functionally different about the brain, then depression qualifies. So why isn't it treated by neurologists?
You said earlier it's partly a fossil. Let's dig into that.
The fossil has two layers. First, the historical accident of how these specialties formed. Neurology came out of 19th century neuropathology, physicians like Charcot and Broca who were literally mapping lesions to deficits in hospital wards. Their whole framework was, find the damaged tissue, explain the symptom. Psychiatry came out of asylum medicine and then psychoanalysis. The focus was on the patient's inner life, their history, their symptoms as meaningful narratives rather than circuit failures. These two traditions built entirely separate professional worlds.
Once you've got separate residency programs, separate journals, separate hospital wings, separate billing codes, the inertia is enormous. You don't merge two specialties just because the science says they overlap.
And there's a second layer. If depression were reclassified as neurological, neurologists would suddenly be responsible for one of the most common conditions in medicine. They don't have the training for the psychological dimensions. Psychiatrists, meanwhile, have built their entire field around treating these conditions. Neither specialty has much incentive to redraw the map.
The boundary persists not because the biology demands it, but because the institutions do.
That's the uncomfortable answer to Daniel's question. The distinction between neurological and psychiatric is real in its consequences. It determines who treats you, what your insurance covers, how your disability claim is evaluated, but it's not grounded in a clean biological divide. It's a professional artifact that we've retrofitted with scientific justification.
Which brings us back to his experience. The ADHD gets the neurologist, the brain scans, the language of dopamine circuits. The depression gets the psychiatrist, the symptom checklist, the language of mood. And he feels the difference in how each condition is treated and in how he thinks about himself.
Let's look at the actual brain data, because this is where Daniel's intuition about ADHD feeling more neurological gets real scientific weight. The dopamine and norepinephrine transporter gene variants, DAT1, DRD4 DALU, show up in study after study. Structural differences in the prefrontal cortex and basal ganglia are consistent enough that you can almost set your watch by them. And the functional MRI findings, reduced activation in frontostriatal circuits during executive function tasks, are so replicable that some researchers have argued they should be used diagnostically.
Which is not something you hear people say about depression.
You don't. And the heritability numbers tell the same story. ADHD's heritability sits at 70 to 80%, comparable to autism and bipolar disorder. Depression's heritability is around 40%. The environmental contribution is much larger. Childhood adversity, chronic stress, trauma. That doesn't make depression less real, but it makes it harder to point at a clean genetic architecture and say, this is a brain disease in the classical sense.
The ADHD brain has a relatively distinct signature. The depressed brain has a lot of things going on, but they're harder to separate from everything else that might be happening in that person's life.
That's exactly the specificity problem. The hippocampal volume reduction, 8 to 10% in recurrent depression, is real. But it also shows up in anxiety disorders, in PTSD, and even in people with chronic stress who don't meet criteria for any diagnosis. The default mode network hyperconnectivity correlates with rumination generally, not just depressive rumination. The HPA axis dysfunction tracks early life adversity more than it tracks any particular diagnostic category. A neurologist looking at a single patient's scan can't say this is depression. They can say this brain shows signs of chronic stress or affective dysregulation. That's not enough to anchor a neurological diagnosis. Neurology's whole framework is built on specificity. This lesion, this circuit, this deficit. If the same biomarker shows up across five different conditions, and also in people who aren't clinically ill, it doesn't function as a diagnostic tool in the way neurologists need.
Here's what I find interesting. The treatment response patterns basically confirm the same divide.
Stimulants target the identified neurotransmitter deficits in ADHD directly, dopamine and norepinephrine, and the effects are rapid and predictable. You can see the difference within an hour of the first dose. Antidepressants modulate broader systems, serotonin, norepinephrine, with delayed, variable responses. 4 to 6 weeks before you know if it's working, and a significant percentage of patients don't respond to the first medication at all.
Which suggests the problem in depression isn't a focal deficit. You can just top up.
It's more consistent with a systems-level dysregulation. The thermostat is badly calibrated, the windows are open, someone keeps adjusting it. The whole climate control system has gone wrong, and it's hard to say which part is the cause and which parts are downstream effects. Whereas ADHD looks more like a specific circuit that's underactive, you can target it, and the system responds.
That's a useful way to think about it, but I want to push on something. You said the ADHD neuroanatomical signatures are relatively distinct. How relative is relatively?
That's a fair question. They're distinct compared to depression, but they're not as clean as, say, a stroke lesion. There's still heterogeneity. Not everyone with ADHD shows the same prefrontal cortex volume reduction. The frontostriatal hypoactivation pattern shows up in about 70% of cases in most studies, strong but not universal. And some of these findings overlap with other conditions that involve executive dysfunction, like certain types of traumatic brain injury.
It's a gradient, not a binary.
It's absolutely a gradient, and that's really the core of what Daniel's question exposes. The neurological psychiatric divide has some empirical basis. ADHD does have more specific, more replicable neurobiological signatures than depression, but it's not a clean line. It's a spectrum of how tightly the biology maps onto the diagnosis, and where we draw the boundary is as much about history and institutions as it is about brain science.
Which means the practical consequences we're about to get into. Who treats you? What your insurance covers? How you think about yourself? Are being shaped by a line that's scientifically blurrier than most people realize. Let's get concrete. Daniel's living with both these diagnoses. What does this divide actually mean for someone in his position day to day?
The first thing it means is he's probably got two specialists who don't talk to each other. The neurologist managing his ADHD can prescribe stimulants, order an EEG or fMRI if needed, and think in terms of dopamine circuits. The psychiatrist managing his depression prescribes the SSRI and might provide therapy. These are different offices, different medical record systems, different clinical languages.
Daniel's left coordinating his own brain between them.
Which is absurd when you consider that up to 30% of people with ADHD have comorbid depression. This isn't a rare edge case. It's a substantial minority of ADHD patients, and the system essentially guarantees they'll fall through the gap between specialties.
What about the insurance side? Because I suspect that's where the label really bites.
It bites hard. Neurological diagnoses generally have clearer pathways for disability accommodations and insurance coverage. If you've got a neurologist saying this patient has a documented frontostriatal circuit dysfunction, the paperwork moves differently than if a psychiatrist says this patient meets DSM criteria for major depressive disorder. ADHD is increasingly recognized under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But depression claims still face higher scrutiny, more requests for additional documentation, more skepticism about whether the impairment is real.
Even though the functional impairment can be comparable.
A severe depression can be more disabling than moderate ADHD, but the person with depression has to work harder to prove it. The label shapes the institutional response before anyone looks at the actual impact on the person's life.
Then there's the identity piece Daniel raised directly. The ADHD feels like him. The depression feels like something that happened to him.
That distinction shows up consistently in the research on illness narratives. When people receive a neurological label, they tend to describe the condition as part of who they are, intrinsic, biological, morally neutral. With psychiatric labels, even when the symptoms are equally severe, there's more self-blame. More, I should be able to think my way out of this. The label itself changes how people relate to their own suffering.
Which has treatment implications, doesn't it? If you think your depression is a character flaw rather than a brain phenomenon, you might resist medication in ways you wouldn't for ADHD.
And it cuts the other way, too. Some people with ADHD resist the idea that it's neurological because they don't want to feel broken. The label carries different meanings for different people, but it's never neutral.
The comorbidity question seems central here. Daniel's theory is that the depression is basically downstream of the ADHD, a consequence of the life friction it creates.
The longitudinal data supports that to a point, Studies show that ADHD precedes depression in 60 to 70% of cases where both are present. A 2024 JAMA Psychiatry study found that adults with ADHD who received stimulant treatment had a 40% lower risk of developing depression over 5 years. That's a substantial effect, and it supports the consequence model pretty strongly.
It's not a 100% reduction.
It's not, and that's the trap. If you assume depression is purely secondary to ADHD and treat only the ADHD, you leave a lot of people still depressed. The relationship is bidirectional. Chronic depression also impairs executive function, which can worsen ADHD symptoms. There are likely shared mechanisms. Dopaminergic dysfunction plays a role in both conditions, though in different ways.
Treating the ADHD might reduce the depression risk, but once depression is established, it often needs its own intervention.
And that's where the single specialist model fails. You need someone who can think about both conditions simultaneously, not a neurologist for one and a psychiatrist for the other with no communication between them.
Which brings us to where this whole framework might be heading. You mentioned the NIMH's Research Domain Criteria Project.
The RDOC framework is explicitly trying to blow up the neurological-psychiatric divide. Instead of organizing mental illness by DSM categories, it organizes by underlying brain circuits and behavioral dimensions, cognitive systems, positive valence systems, negative valence systems, and so on. The idea is that a given patient might have dysfunction across multiple circuits regardless of which diagnostic box they fit into.
Instead of, you have ADHD and depression, it becomes, you have dysfunction in these three circuits, and here's how they interact.
That's the vision. And a 2025 Nature Reviews neuroscience paper argued that circuit-based psychiatry could replace categorical diagnoses entirely within a decade, not just for research, for clinical practice. You'd walk into a clinic, and instead of getting a DSM label, you'd get a circuit profile.
Which would make Daniel's experience legible in a way the current system isn't. The ADHD isn't a separate condition from the depression. They're different expressions of overlapping circuit dysfunctions.
That maps much better onto what he actually feels. The ADHD feels intrinsic because it's tied to core cognitive circuits that have been that way since childhood. The depression feels reactive because it involves circuits that are responding to life experience. But they're all brain circuits. The distinction isn't real versus not real, it's developmental versus reactive, and both are biological. Given all this, what should someone in Daniel's position actually do differently? Because the science is fascinating, but he's living it.
And I think the first thing is pushing back on the treat the depression first reflex. A lot of clinicians still default to that. Get the mood stabilized, then we'll look at the ADHD. But the evidence doesn't support sequencing it that way.
It really doesn't. That JAMA psychiatry study we mentioned, 40% lower risk of developing depression over 5 years with stimulant treatment, that's not a small signal. And clinically, what you often see is that when the ADHD is properly managed, the depression lifts partly on its own. Not always, not completely, but enough that you're treating a milder residual depression rather than a full episode.
Because you've removed the source of a lot of the life friction. The missed deadlines, the forgotten commitments, the constant sense of underperforming. That stuff grinds people down.
So, actionable point number one. If you've got both diagnoses, don't accept a sequential approach without a good reason. The evidence supports treating them simultaneously, and stimulants can improve mood by reducing ADHD-related dysfunction even before you touch the serotonin system.
Second thing, the accommodations landscape. If you need disability support at work or school, how you frame the diagnosis matters.
It shouldn't, but it does. A neurologist's note saying frontostriatal circuit dysfunction opens doors differently than a psychiatrist's note saying major depressive disorder. Both are valid, both describe real impairment, but the institutional machinery responds to the neurological framing more readily. So if you have ADHD, lead with that. Get the documentation from the specialist who can speak the language the system recognizes.
Which is deeply cynical, but also just practical advice.
It's not cynical to understand how the system actually works and navigate accordingly. The principle shouldn't matter, but the practice does.
Third, and this is for both patients and clinicians, the whole neurological-psychiatric divide is increasingly artificial. Look for providers who treat the whole person, not just the diagnostic category. Integrated care models consistently show better outcomes for comorbid conditions. You want someone who can think about your dopamine circuits and your serotonin circuits at the same time, not two people in separate buildings who never compare notes.
That's getting easier to find. The RDoC framework is filtering into training programs. Younger clinicians are more comfortable thinking dimensionally, circuits and systems rather than bins. If you're looking for a new provider, ask how they handle comorbidity. If they say, we'll treat the depression first and see what's left, that's a yellow flag.
The broader takeaway here, and this is where I think Daniel's intuition lands, is that his sense of ADHD as intrinsic and depression as reactive has real scientific support, but it's oversimplified. Both conditions involve brain biology. Both show up on scans and in neurotransmitter systems. The difference isn't that one is real and the other isn't. It's that ADHD has more specific, more tightly localized signatures, while depression is more diffuse, more entangled with life experience.
Specificity, not fundamentality. That's the distinction that actually holds up. And it means Daniel's experience. This feels like my brain, this feels like something that happened to my brain, is tracking something genuine. It's just that both of them are, ultimately, brain phenomena.
The labels matter less than finding what works, but understanding why the labels exist and what they do to you makes it a lot easier to navigate the system without internalizing the wrong parts of it. This raises a bigger question that's worth leaving you with. As brain imaging gets sharper and biomarkers get more specific, does this whole neurological psychiatric wall just collapse completely? Or do we discover that some conditions really are more circuit-specific than others, and the divide was onto something, just clumsily?
I think the answer is probably both, which is the most annoying possible answer, but also the most honest. The 2025 Nature Reviews neuroscience piece I mentioned basically argues that within a decade, we could see depression split into subtypes. Some will look neurological in the classical sense. Inflammation-driven depression, for instance, where you can point at specific immune pathways and say, there, that's the mechanism. Others will remain more cognitive and behavioral, tied to life patterns and learned responses that happen to have biological correlates, the way everything mental has biological correlates.
Which would transform treatment matching. Instead of try this SSRI and come back in 6 weeks, it becomes, your depression has this inflammatory signature, so we're targeting that pathway specifically.
That's already happening in research settings. The people studying C-reactive protein and IL-6 as treatment guides aren't waiting for the DSM to catch up. They're just doing it.
Daniel's intuition, ADHD feels intrinsic, depression feels secondary, is valid, but the science suggests both are brain phenomena. The labels matter less than finding what works.
I think that's the landing. The distinction between neurological and psychiatric has shaped everything about how these conditions are treated, funded, and understood. But it's a map, not the territory. The territory is a brain with multiple things going on, some more hardwired than others, all of them real.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, British soldiers stationed in what is now Belize documented a form of hurling played by Irish settlers along the Belize River. A single source surviving description that remains the only known record of organized hurling in Central America during the colonial period.
I genuinely don't know what to do with that information.
I'm going to assume the Irish settlers won.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop, our producer, for whatever that was. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a question that's been nagging at you the way this one nagged at Daniel, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We're at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.